welcome to the Sorbet Mesa podcast with me, as always, your host, Alan Maguire. If you're new here, then this is a podcast looking at contemporary and plural Spain, both the past, present, and future. We do cover a lot of history, but we don't just read from a book and tell you on here. I actually get the experts on to explain their latest research or their previous research, or I might interview the writer of a book that I generally have read. For the present, I normally get on activists or journalists that are covering Spain daily, not sort of what you might call your stereotypical Anglo-Saxon journalist, but journalists that actually do look into the politics of the nation and report it in English. And then for the future, I try to interview activists that are working on projects to try and bring awareness to something in the community or in Spain in general. So take a look back at our previous episodes. The first four or five are terrible because it was just me playing around and experimenting. This podcast has actually been going a year now, so it's kind of cool. We are, you know, on our way to around 800 listeners a week, maybe. I'm slowing down the production of the podcast. It's going to be every 2 to 3 weeks, depending on my workload and guests' workloads. Everyone's doing this for free. But I do hope that you enjoy the podcast. And if you do, please leave us a review and share it with your friends and family. Maybe you've got friends and family that live in Spain. Or maybe you've got Spanish friends that want to practice their English, which is always nice. If they can understand my thick West Country accent from the southwest of the UK, then I'm sure they're above, well, they're heading towards the advanced level. We're going to be hopefully working a bit more with a company called Are We Europe? It's a media organization that's trying to break borders in Europe and trying to report untold stories, just as I hope we're doing here, really. So one of their latest episodes was called Josh and Franco. It's a father and son, you know, sort of coming of age story. But it's quite interesting because it's told in parallel. So you sort of see them both aging together. And it's from the south of Italy as well, which, you know, is an area of the world I have yet to explore. And this is an episode from a series called This Is What a Generation Sounds Like. And their tagline is sort of intimate stories from across the continent as told by young Europeans experiencing them. And it's done in cooperation with a podcast called The Europeans and Elixir Kölfestum, an independent non-for-profit cultural foundation committed to strengthening cohesion in Europe using art and culture. And I really did actually enjoy it. And Our Europe has a podcast family. So if you take a look at the website, you can see all these different podcasts of Europeans traveling to different European countries and sort of sharing stories from the continent that are generally not told. And I did find it really interesting. With me today, I have a guest who is going to be talking about the controversial Catalan pardons. So I hope you enjoy this episode. And don't forget to check out the Josh and Franco episode from Are We Europe as well. Okay, so with me today, I have Andrew Dowling, who is a lecturer at Cardiff University on Spanish and Catalan history. Welcome back to Sobremesa,
Andrew. Thank you very much for having me again.
It's a pleasure. So Andrew, this week's been very busy in Spain with regards to the presidential pardon of 9 Catalan political activists and politicians that have been in prison for some of them the last 3.5 years, right?
That's right, yes.
And it's been quite controversial, not just a left and right divide, but, you know, there's people on the left that disagree with it. There's people on the right that agree with it. It's not a clear cut ideological question of left versus right. I was just wondering, though, if you could give us a bit of a recap about why these people are in prison, and how we got to the point of how they got to the point of having a pardon from the president.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, now we've got a little bit more perspective. But if we think back, really, I mean, this is all about the events between September and November of 2017. And I think, you know, it's really no exaggeration now to speak about that autumn of 2017 as probably the most dramatic Spain has experienced since the coup attempt of February 1981. There were so many things wrapped up in that political conflict. It was intense emotionally. It kind of affected all of Spain. I know you're in Madrid and you will have seen the, if you want, the proliferation suddenly towards in November of the Spanish flags being hung from balconies. So it was really, you know, it was a real kind of like dramatic moment. So to cut a long story short, what we know is that essentially two individuals who are part of cultural organizations, Jordi Cuixart and Jordi Sánchez, were held on, essentially on remand, held in custody from September 2017 for a massive demonstration that was almost spontaneously organized, where they climbed on top of two Guardia Civil cars and called on the protesters to leave. But they were then subsequently charged with incitement and sedition, and they were kind of like, you know, convicted. Then we've got, if you want, the political leaders. So seven political leaders who were in the Catalan government in the autumn of 2017, who were also subsequently, arrested, really, or submitted to arrest in November and December 2017. They were subsequently put on trial. So all of the nine individuals, so two leaders of civic organizations and seven members of the political class, were subsequently put on trial by the Spanish judicial authorities, and sentences came out almost 2 years later, giving them what has, I think, near universally outside of Spain been seen as incredibly harsh sentences, for most of them between 9 and 13 years. This was a kind of like a dramatic endpoint, really, to everything that happened in the autumn of 2017. The sentencing, I think, of those politicians really added salt in the wound for the vast majority of Catalans, whether they're supportive or opposed to independence. You know, in Spain, of course, you'll certainly hear people say that the sentencing was too soft, but I've yet to hear or encounter a single commentator outside Spain who felt that the sentencing was too soft. So these are the people that have been released. And, you know, we can sort of talk about perhaps the context of what's brought that about. So hopefully that gives us some sort of contextualization.
And they were convicted of, they were put in jail as well, but they've also been told that they can't hold political office, right, for a certain amount of time. And that's stayed with the pardons, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Yeah, there's still, in the case of Oriol Junqueras, for example, from Esquerra Republicana, he's got the highest level of disbarment. He's disbarred from public office for 6 years, but they've all got varying degrees. And I think the reason why I mentioned this kind of like how internationally the sentencing was seen as incredibly harsh is because they were all charged with, initially they were charged with rebellion and sedition, which are actually charges that don't exist in most European countries. They're not on the legal statute. And I think there was a universal sense that kind of intensity of, you know, like rebellion might be appropriate for what happened in Spain in February 1981, when you put the tanks in the streets and you launch a military coup. But they broke the law, and they knowingly, if you want, broke the law, if you want to speak in those narrow legal terms. But the idea that You could apply to them rebellion or sedition. Really, really was quite jarring. And, you know, Spain has received, obviously, a number of reverses over the years in Belgian and German courts where those leaders who fled were refused extradition. And we can anticipate something else is going to happen with the European Court of Justice as well. So it's clear that, the judicial system engaged in, you know, Spanish justice is also rather heavily politicized. And I think a very conservative court interpreted these legal charges in a very narrow and also, I think, very strongly political way.
And I mean, talking about, there's a lot there to talk about, but like talking about outside impressions, you know, it was, I think, for a lot of Spaniards, for a fair number of Spaniards that might agree with the pardons, it was embarrassing that Rajoy reacted in the way he did in 2017, and that these political activists and politicians were given like lengthy jail sentences. Yes. The former king running around the United Emirates, not paying his taxes and all sorts of things like that. So, yeah, I think as well, something that's just because people don't agree with the sentencing doesn't mean that they think they're innocent. I mean, there's other ways of punishing people that doesn't involve sending them to prison for 13 years, right?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And of course, what the government's done with the pardon is not saying that they're innocent. It's saying we've agreed to, if you want, forgive you for your crimes, in inverted commas.
Mm. Yeah, and the pardons have been, the courts have been, that was as often seen as quite political. Outside of Spain, I think less so. I think it's less obvious how political the courts are. To the outside of Spain, but like in Spain at the moment, the jury is politically appointed, right? And it needs to be appointed by, I think, 2/3 of the Congress. And normally it's sort of seen as, between the PP and the PSOE, the two largest parties, it's seen as sort of common courtesy to vote to renew the judiciary. But yes, the PP haven't renewed it this time because they don't like the fact that the PSOE are in government with Podemos, and they actually see them as, I think the word illegitimate has been used a lot. There is a real grounding for sort of saying that the judiciary has been to an extent politicized. But also there's a lot of people sort of saying that Pedro Sanchez has done this for political reasons because he relies upon the ERC, which is the left-wing Catalan Republicans, for those that don't know, for his majority in parliament. So I just wondered if you could comment on the nature of the pardons and what you think about it and its possible trajectory.
Yeah. Well, I think clearly there are a vast number of explanations and probably all of these explanations have an element of truth in it. It is the case that particularly with the implosion of Ciudadanos, it's pretty much, it's a dead man walking, yeah, really, as a political party, that it's an unreliable ally for Pedro Sanchez, thinking about the next two and a half years of Spanish government, and he is to some extent reliant on Esquerra Republicana. But I think you can make, to some extent, there is a kind of like an element where it is useful politically for the Spanish government to have that kind of like strategy of peacemaking, if you want, with the Catalan Republican left. But I think it's clear actually that the context of these pardons is really the greatest political clash that Spain has experienced since a military coup in February 1981. This has been the greatest political moment that Spain has experienced in four decades. And essentially doing nothing, which Rajoy did for years and years, is not a way to deal with this. And as I mentioned as well, that, for the vast majority of Catalan society, these sentences, this imprisonment of the political leadership, whether they support them or not, really has been taken quite badly. It's a kind of like added salt to the wounds of the autumn of 2017. So I think it was a necessary political measure. To some extent, you can also interpret it as an act of political statesmanship. He's also taken a measure that's politically unpopular in Spain, where, you know, most of the polling showing around 60% plus of Spaniards. So you'd have to be a strange kind of cynic to say that Pedro Sánchez has done it for narrow political reasons when it's actually potentially very damaging to him. So he's I think Pedro Sánchez, you know, I think he can be commended on this particular issue. He's taken a political risk, he's taken a political gamble, but I think it is also a necessary political gamble given the intensity and the fraughtness of the political conflict that Spain has experienced over the Catalan question in recent years.
I think that's that's a good summary of how I've viewed it, really. I mean, you know, people say take ideology out of it, really. And I think he has, because apparently a lot of PSOE supporters are completely against it. So, and, you know, it's as you said, it's a political gamble. And I suppose we're going to have to wait and see how it plays out. The people that were released have sort of come out and said, you know, we're not free until Catalonia is free, and they held up a banner saying freedom for Catalonia. What do you think of their reaction to the pardons, and how do you think this is going to play out in Catalonia, where the PSOE are getting more popular, but they've never been terribly popular. How do you think this is going to play out with regards to the politics of the independence sort of area?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's pretty clear as well. You know, I mentioned that we've now got, you know, a bit of distance with the events of the autumn of 2017. And it's pretty obvious, I think, now for all reasonable commentators as well, that whatever it, however serious was the attempt to break from Spain rather than the autumn of 2017, was a complete and utter failure, however you kind of like frame it. So, you know, we're going to see lots of kind of like political rhetoric about, you know, we still believe in the cause for independence, etc. But there is no, for the next couple of years at least, there is no meaningful route for Catalonia to attempt what it attempted in the autumn of 2017. You know, the number of major miscalculations that were made in the autumn of 2017, I think particularly in terms of international interest and international recognition, you know, 3.5 years after the declaration of independence by the Catalan Parliament, not one country in the world has recognized Catalan independence. So it's clear that, you know, you can continue the cause, you can continue the cause for Scottish independence, you can continue the cause for Irish unity, but it'd be very naive to think that these are kind of like imminent political achievements that are, you know, are just around the corner. So I think Catalan independence is in a kind of like a transitional phase. Sure, that, you know, the rhetoric is inevitable after the release of this political leadership, you know, that we still believe in the cause and we want Catalonia to be free and independent and all that. I would see that as perhaps natural political rhetoric coming from people released from prison. But the actual real reality is that Catalan independence is not imminent. And certainly I think we're entering a new phase of the political conflict, which will, I think, continue, you know, taking a risk here, making predictions about the future, will continue until the next Spanish general election. That we'll see kind of like, you know, it all kind of rise and fall. We'll see some low intensity conflicts, but we won't see anything on a dramatic scale that we saw in the autumn of 2017. Even the Catalan government has said and has agreed amongst the two main pro-independence parties that they've got 2 years to try to see if they can obtain some meaningful concessions from Madrid. So I think that's where we're going to be, in a relatively calm environment for the next couple of years. But, you know, never make predictions about the future as well, no. because events can always throw you off course. But I think assuming that there isn't anything dramatic happening in terms of like the collapse of the Spanish government and early elections, etc., etc., I think we can anticipate, you know, 18 months to 2 years of sort of politics, of negotiations. Whether they can solve the Catalan question is a very different issue altogether. And I'm actually, if you want, quite pessimistic about the ability of the political negotiations to provide any meaningful medium or long-term solution to the Catalan question.
And I mean, with regards to the opposition to these pardons, it's been quite, it's been big, but it's not been the backlash that Vox and the PP were probably, you know, hoping for, really. I mean, we've had the PP going around sort of collecting signatures, asking for Pedro Sanchez to resign. And then we had the Colón part two. So for anyone that doesn't know, about 3 or 4 years ago, there's a famous photo of the leader of Ciudadanos at the time, Alberto Rivera, Pablo Casado, and forgotten his name now. Santiago Abascal from Vox all stood in a line. It was like the Spanish right in Plaza Colón next to Plaza Margaret Thatcher in the center of Madrid. And they tried to recreate that this time, but they refused to, the politicians refused to sort of stand next to each other. How do you think this is going to play out with regards on to a national level between the opposition and against, obviously, the government?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the reason why I'm, if you want, broadly pessimistic about any long-term or medium-term solution to the Catalan question is, I think to solve meaningfully the Catalan question, you do need the Spanish right on board, because it needs to be a state agreement where you would talk about changing, you know, the political infrastructure of Spain, creating a truly federal system and things like that. And that's just impossible. The Spanish right are incapable, really, of recognizing and dealing naturally with what is the plurinational reality of Spain in terms of not just Catalonia, but Valencia, Galicia, the Basque Country, the Canary Islands, the Balearics. You know, it's a recognition that essentially so much of the Spanish right refuses, really, to countenance, refuses to consider. And I think this means that the Catalan question becomes, as it did under the second administration of Aznar, and to some extent under Rajoy, it becomes a kind of stick used by the Spanish right to try to undermine, to try to erode the Spanish government. So if you want, you know, in Northern Ireland, they used to talk about, or in 100 years ago in British politics with Northern Ireland, they talk about the orange card is the one to play, as in to kind of like to mobilize in Britain against kind of like concessions to Irish Home Rule. So for the Spanish right, the Catalan card is the one to play, because in general terms, that can they see that as their key card that they can play in a cynical political way to mobilize, to obtain support and to rally round the flag. So, you know, all of this narrative, this discourse that the PSOE are destroying Spain, they're, you know, making agreements with separatists, they're threatening the unity of Spain. All of this narrative just adds fuel to the fire and actually makes resolution of the Catalan question even more difficult, because it kind of like communicates indirectly to Catalans that, well, actually, a lot of Spain doesn't want you. A lot of Spain doesn't particularly see you as welcome, doesn't recognize your language, culture and identity as something Spanish. Because if Spain was, or if the Spanish political class, including the right, was mature and capable of recognizing difference, you would be celebrating, say, Catalan language and culture as something inherently Spanish and talking about the richness of Spain in terms of its linguistic diversity. But this is just something that, you know, is deeply rooted historically in the Spanish right, that they cannot get their head around this. They can't process it. They can't process this diversity, and they can't accept it. So although we will see sort of politics between Madrid and Barcelona, between the Catalan government and the Spanish government taking place the next 18 months to years, any concessions that are perceived to be made towards the Catalans, in inverted commas, will be used as a battering ram by the forces of the Spanish right to try to erode support for the current Spanish coalition government.
And yeah, I think it seems to be working at the moment, because the PP are up in the polls. I don't know what it will be like in the next couple of weeks. We'll have to look at the polls, but they've gone up in the polls. But obviously, there could be other reasons for that as well. With regards to more society, do you think there will be a chilling, or can you see a chilling of relations between Catalonia and Spain on a more ground level? Because it's been quite toxic for years. I mean, it's calming down quite a bit now, but you know, there's still thousands of flags out there on balconies and things like that.
Yeah, well, I think in one sense, this political opportunity now and sort of, you know, the negotiations that are going to take place over the next 12 months will allow for some de-escalation of conflict. Because I think in one sense, you can say, going back to kind of like, you know, we're now talking about, you know, 2005, six over the Statute of Autonomy. I think one of the precipitators of the push for Catalan independence, what we call for, what they felt was a lack of recognition on the part of Madrid, that Madrid essentially kind of like refused to recognize their special identity, their special place in Spain, and you know, a political decision, if you want, was made by amongst many Catalans that the only way we can resolve this is by leaving Spain, that there is no happy accommodation within Spain. So I think the fact that we're in the era of politics for the next 18 months is a broadly hopeful sign, but I do reiterate the fact that with a hostile Spanish right, it really will allow any hints of concessions to Catalonia to be seen as you know, as a really major tool to you know, to operate and try to erode and undermine the current Spanish government. They know, the Spanish right know, that there's real political traction with what we can call anti-Catalan sentiment, and that is something that is deeply ingrained, deeply rooted. And you know, as you also indicated in your introduction at the beginning, this is something that isn't just within the Spanish right. There are strong sections of the voting base and the leadership of the Spanish Socialist Party who broadly share this narrative of around the question of Spanish unity and Spanish kind of culture and identity. So it's really going to be, you know, it's going to be walking a tightrope. But I think what I would also add as well is that the broader context of hopefully emerging from COVID and beginning to return to some degree of normality, you know, the emergency funding that's coming in from Europe may allow for some greater degree of focus on social and economic issues as well, in parallel with the political negotiations. So again, you know, sticking my neck out, I think we will see for at least the next 18 months a de-escalation of tension. And I think that symbolic moment earlier this week of releasing the prisoners will allow for that, if you want, temporary renegotiation of positions between, you know, sectors of Catalan society and the Spanish government.
And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the different parties' positions on Catalonia, because from on the left, sort of Podemos seem a bit lost with regards to, I mean, they support Pedro Sánchez's pardons, but they don't really, they've I think it was in another episode with Caroline Gray, where she sort of pointed out they don't really have a territorial position on Catalonia. And it seems to really affect them.
Yes, well, I think they started off with a relatively, you know, sophisticated and honest position, which was really talking about the plurinational identity of Spain and supportive of that. And I think, you know, in particular, Pablo Iglesias, who obviously has now departed the scene, Pablo Iglesias was quite important and quite supportive of that narrative. But Yes, if you actually look at some of the hard data on support for Podemos amongst their voters, it's not necessarily so clear that all of their supporters share this narrative around the complexity of Spain. I think Podemos supporters are much more likely to see, the Catalans to some extent and Basque nationalists as tending to be kind of like right-wing conservative forces, right. And they're much more interested in real social and economic issues, and much less interested in the question of the nation. And I think that's providing, in a sense, an opportunity for the Spanish Socialist Party under Pedro Sánchez, who has made a shift really in position, to sort of occupy that territory. But I think Podemos is in crisis really, and it's in crisis for a variety of political reasons. And yes, it hasn't got a clearly articulated position on the national question, and hence we hear discordant voices from some of the leading figures within Podemos about how they should be approaching this question.
And I suppose on the other side of things is the PP, which they seem to be the biggest. From what I've seen this morning, Pablo Casado seems to be completely lost with this issue, really. Squeezed between the moderate sort of PSOE and position and the sort of hardline Vox position. It seems that he's sort of just a bit lost, really. And then there was the comment from, who many people think is going to sort of take over as leader of the PP, Isabel Ayuso, the president of the Comunidad of Madrid. She made a comment at the Colón protest last week around, why does the king have to sign these pardons, knowing full well that it's sort of a symbolic gesture rather than anything else. And in certain articles, they've even said that Pedro Sánchez has got the church, the king, and the employers on his side. Which is quite the achievement for doing something that was so unpopular. So I just wondered what you thought about Pablo Casado's position at the moment on Catalonia, but also in the PP.
Yeah, well, I think it clearly goes back to this issue that I've mentioned, that there's a lot of political mileage in Spain to wave the flag, to wave the Spanish flag, to talk about Spanish unity, to talk about Spanish identity broadly defined. That's been a long running constant theme. And it's clear that Pablo Casado is terrified about being kind of like, overtaken by Vox, which is, unambiguous on what it thinks should be the solution to this question. So Pablo Casado clearly had a strategy, but it's beginning to unravel, as you rightly indicate. I mean, I think it's very interesting that the Spanish Employers Organization and the Spanish bishops have talked about, the need for reconciliation. Yeah. This is, those of us who go back a few years ago under the leadership of Rodrigo Zapatero, and can remember, for example, the ultra-conservative radio broadcaster run by Catholic Church, COPE, with its mourning, bromides and hostility against the Spanish socialist government. I think this is an important development that's really taken some of the sails out of Pablo Casado. But I think the problem is that Pablo Casado cannot do what is necessary in this case, which is an act of statesmanship to say Spain has confronted an enormous political problem and we need a reevaluation of the political structures of Spain to give the Catalans a home. And contrast the political narrative in the UK around Scotland, particularly the referendum of 2014, when you had like people like David Bowie saying, please don't leave us, Scotland, we love you. What was called at the time the love bombing of Scotland by leading British figures. The Spanish right are incapable of saying to the Catalans or the Basques or others in Spain, we really love you, we really value what you are, what you want to be, we love and respect your language, culture and identity, we see them as part of our kind of great diverse Spain. They're incapable of doing that. Their only narrative is hostility and criticism of varying levels. And therefore, you know, I mentioned that we can hope that we've got a couple of years of peace ahead of us in terms of you know, political negotiation and calm and political agreement making, really, between the governments of Barcelona and Madrid. But I do think, and I just mentioned this, that if the PP come to power in Madrid, as in at a state level, if the Spanish government is changed in the next 2 or 3 years or whenever, and we get a PP government that is supported by Vox in the Spanish parliament in Madrid, I think all bets are off, because I think then we will almost inevitably see a massive revival of Catalan independence sentiment. We will also see the Basque country being really concerned at kind of like this strong right-wing Spanish nationalist administration. You know, if Ayuso one day becomes prime minister with the support of Vox, for me, all bets are off. You know, when I say what could happen in the next 18 months, 2 years, are assuming that the current Spanish government stays in power. But I think if and when we get a two-party right-wing Spanish government, for me, that will produce incredible political instability in Spain.
Mm, yeah. No, I dread to think of it, to be honest with you.
Yes.
I mean, it's, I'm laughing, but it's a very scary thought that that could, and it is quite possible, because, you know, the PP, if you look at the polling at the moment, the PP would get a majority with Vox.
Absolutely.
And I mean, there's no election for the next 2 years, but you know, the PP aren't going to get an absolute majority on their own as things stand at the moment. If they had a change in leader, maybe that might change. But, you know, it looks like if they wanted to form a government on a national level, that they would seek the support of Vox. And as we've seen in Andalusia and Murcia and several other places there, you know, that's not something that they're afraid to do.
Yeah. And just to add one quick point on this, that, you know, bizarrely, really, but I think it's accurate. Mariano Rajoy was actually a moderate element within the Popular Party.
Yeah.
So if what comes after Rajoy is worse than the Rajoy administration, as you know, as you indicate, I mean, it's a pretty horrifying thought.
Yeah. And I suppose as well, you know, Pablo Casado is kind of ideologically empty. I think he's a bit of a, you know, he sort of swings positions, doesn't really know where he stands. But the people that are likely to succeed him, I mean, the main one being Ayuso, really, she certainly knows where she stands, and it's certainly not moderate. Maybe people might call her moderate in an economic sense. I don't think so, but I suppose there's none in there. But I don't think she's moderate in any form when it comes to culture, really.
Well, no, but I suppose just one kind of addendum to that. I think Ayuso would be seriously erroneous if she thinks Spain is the same as Madrid.
Yeah.
You know, that you can have this narrative to have incredible traction in Madrid as the city, and that, you know, it helped achieve her electoral victory, but the rest of Spain is not the same. This is all speculating on how things are going to pan out in the Popular Party. There's also Alberto Feijóo in Galicia, who's clearly from the moderate ring, but he may not get a chance. You know, it's we're certainly seeing patterns and phenomenon in the right across Europe where, you know, moderate wings are being pushed aside. We've seen it in Britain. We've seen it in the Republicans in the US. We see it in other parties. So there may not be any opportunity for moderation.
No. Which is, of course, very worrying.
Yes.
Andrew, thank you very much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
You're welcome.
And I hope you come back. I hope it's not too soon. I hope there's no drama too soon. But you're always welcome back to discuss the workings of Catalonia.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks.